home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening, good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am Rob Watson. Big thanks to our executive producer, Garrett Miller. Also want to give a quick shout-out to for his production work on this episode, Brody Levesque, as always, and he's part of our panel that we'll be bringing on very shortly. Tonight, we are going to be talking about hot LGBTQ topics that are going on, but in this current news environment, a lot of them are not getting really the discussion that they would have pre-Trump or pre-Trump era. And so we're going to rectify that a little bit tonight. I have on as my panel our regular journalists, Brody Levesque and Karen Eckham, who are seasoned journalists, both West Coast and East Coast. But tonight we are also being joined by yet another distinguished journalist, Dan Avery. Dan is editor-in-chief of New Now Next, Logo's TV news and entertainment site. He has covered LGBTQ issues for 20 years, or more than 20 years, including Advocate, Out Magazine, Queerty, Washington Post. He was born and raised in Baltimore, and he has called New York City home for the past 17 years. So I want to welcome Dan onto the show. Good evening, Dan.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. Yeah, I would love to have called New York home for the last 17 years. I love New York City. That must be a blast. You know, normally, when a place has a sun that reaches the highest office in the land, you know, the place is all about that. But New York is also one of the most progressive places on the planet. What is the tone nowadays, having birthed Trump for us all?
Yeah, we try not to draw the connection between the two. Favorite son, maybe not the right phrase.
Okay, all right. Our little secret, we'll table that for now and forever. So I do want to bring on our other panelists, Brody, good evening, and Karen, good evening, folks.
Hello.
Welcome to the table.
Good evening, Rob. Hey, Dan. Hey, Karen.
Hey.
So you guys have been out there covering the beat from all different angles for some time. Let's start throwing some topics on the table. The first one I wanted to bring up was a press release released by Tony Perkins and the Family Research Council. And shorthanding it, you guys can go into more detail. But basically, he's putting a call out to the African-American community to become more homophobic. Dan, what is your take on that, and have you covered this?
Yes, we're covering it, and I actually talked to Brody a little bit about this earlier. I mean, it's really crass, and you know, they tried this during the marriage equality push to kind of drive a wedge between two groups that have kind of a natural connection, and it didn't really work then, and I don't think it's gonna work now. And I mean, that doesn't mean I'm not disgusted by it, but it seems so craven to me.
Well, the one question I have though for you, because out here in California, when they were doing that, and Karen, maybe you can speak to it because you're
I have
tied
lots
in the press
to say
out
on
here.
This.
Yeah, because during Prop 8, and it wasn't like the whole African-American community became anti-gay, but I think there was some significant effect to the point of potentially turning that. Karen, what is your input on it?
Well, first of all, let me stop you right there because, a lot of people – cite an AP poll that came out, really right after, I think it was an exit poll, right after the election, and it suggested that the vote was really tilted by the African American vote, and that was later not only so disproven, but just like really hurt. It wound up hurting a lot of people, and wound up hurting, you know, the coalition. But let me go back a little bit, even before Prop 8, and just, you know, this is an unholy alliance, as it were. I remember, because I've been out here covering this crap with these people for a very long time, and I don't know if you remember a fellow named Reverend Lou Sheldon from the Traditional Values Coalition.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, this guy... Yeah, and he, you know, he's kind of like, he was a white supremacist, religious right guy from way back in the day. He didn't believe in the civil rights law, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But what wound up happening as gay people, this is before there was really a push for LGBT, gay people started making progress, starting... You know, it's that dual thing where we were making progress and being recognized at the same time that the AIDS crisis is happening. So Lou Sheldon went up against Dr. Virginia Uribe, who was the science teacher at Fairfax High School, who started Project 10, which was essentially a dropout prevention program for LGBT kids. What he wound up doing as Life Lobby started coming to the fore and getting gay legislation passed is that he created an alliance with a woman and basically mentored this woman named Star Parker, who is now a bigwig in the anti-gay African-American, you know, religious liberties movement. She's a friend of the Family Research Council then, and she speaks every year at the Value Voters Summit. And, you know, she used to sit at these symposiums and things and write about how, you know, we want sodomites quarantined. And, you know, Martin Luther King didn't want, you know, didn't protest for sodomites, et cetera, et cetera. The biggest thing, apart from mentoring her, was his alliance with this Harry Jackson, who is the, he's from, let's see, Bishop Harry Jackson. He's from Hope Christian Church, which was a little church out here in the black community, but then he wrote this book, and Lou Sheldon, like, promoted this guy and took him to Washington, D.C., and as you may remember, Harry Jackson played a huge role in the anti-marriage equality movement in D.C. I mean, he was the main guy because he started a church in Virginia, I believe it was, funded by Lou Sheldon's friends. So there's this whole other thing, and they agree primarily on two points. The first point, the most important point for them, is the a point of abortion, because they believe that abortion is kind of like a white ploy to kill, you know, black babies. And then the second thing is that, you know, gay marriage is going to ruin civilization. So there, way before Prop 8, there was the beginning of this alliance. You know, Prop 8, sorry, that's my dog. You know, Prop 8 just exacerbated that. But a lot of that also had to do with the fact that people didn't kind of know whose side to be on because it was religion versus politics. So essentially that's, you know, that's my take. If you want to ask more about I do want to give a shout out to a video, if you ever get a chance to see it, called All God's Children, because John Lewis is in that video and Julian Bond is in that video. And, you know, on our side, talking about human rights, and LGBT rights are human rights. So Julian Bond was the one who, and John Lewis were the ones who really helped spearhead getting recognition at the NAACP and SCLC for us. So
cool.
That's my little two
Brody,
cents.
Brody, you have comments on Karen. Plus, I have a question for you, sort of more East Coast oriented, when you get a chance or when you get through with your comments.
Yeah, I do. Actually, and Dan should remember this from the coverage that we were doing, you know, obviously apart from each other at our own media outlets back then. Bishop Harry Jackson, as Karen just mentioned, had also tried to carpetbag into D.C. He's actually from Lanham, Maryland, which is one of Washington's suburbs, and it's up towards Baltimore. The trioka here was not only just Bishop Harry Jackson, but Ken Blackwell at the Family Research Council and Bernice King, the niece of Dr. Martin Luther King. The problem with what was going on here is the fact that the dynamics of the black church was such, with the messaging going on by people like Harry Jackson and Bernice King and Ken Blackwell, at the Family Research Council, they were trying to make it into a more or less wedge issue. And then there was a delineation, I guess you could call it a delineation of missions, if you will. Family Research Council went one direction with it. The National Organization for Marriage, NOM, went another. And there was also a series of pretty foul mailers that were put out. Dan, you may remember those because the bloggers back then caught on to those that NOM put out. There were remember the ones that were targeted directly at the black community, the black churches? And again, it was, you know, FRC directing this effort to make it a wedge in the black community, and Harry Jackson was the leading voice there, along with Bernice King and Ken Blackwell. So go ahead with your question, Rob.
Right. Yeah, I wanted to ask, and Dan, you can weigh in this, and Karen, too. I mean, it shouldn't necessarily be geo-specific, but it seems to me that this, Karen mentioned the history in California, and I was around for this with where the talk of quarantining and all that was hitting the public airwaves. That has just been brought up recently in Georgia regarding HIV-positive people.
Mm.
And in that context, quite frankly, in kind of cutting through the BS of it all, I took it as being extremely racist, considering the population that is at risk right now for greater risk of HIV spread. And part of the reason that spread and risk is the way it is in the African-American community in the South is these black churches and a lot of this culture. So it seems to me that this is all tying together, with almost a strategy to incite these churches and create an environment where it's kind of a lock 'em up mentality to young African American men with HIV. I mean, what is your comment on that?
Can I jump in for a sec?
Oh, absolutely. Dan, just jump right in on this group.
Sure. I'm so polite. I do think there is, you know, kind of a concerted effort. I guess what I'm wondering is that, you know, the last time we kind of, they kind of all came together was about marriage, and it was a lot easier to rattle African-Americans, church-going African-Americans about marriage and a core, you know, core value of the faith, whereas something like workplace discrimination or telling someone they can't eat in a restaurant or something, I think is a harder sell for, you know, some of these, you know, hate peddlers. At least I hope. Maybe I'm being a little optimistic.
Brody, did you have
I'm not sure I followed you on that. What do you mean it's a harder sell about telling people where they can and cannot eat?
That the success of this, I don't think that this current, you know, campaign that they're waging, I stand with
Jack.
Whatever his name is. I stand with Jack.
Jack, yeah.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
I don't think it's going to have the same resonance as the, you know, the strategy they had with marriage equality. It's harder to kind of tell, you know, people in the church, like, it's okay to fire someone because they're gay than it is to say, you know, marriage is special and it's got to be reserved mm-hmm. for us and all that. And, you know, the flyer that I saw had, you know, one of these has never happened, and had a sink that said white
yeah.
and a sink that said black and a sink that
right.
said rainbow. And maybe, again, maybe I'm, you know, I live in a bubble, you know, I live in New York City, but I would take offense at that, you know, to sort of, rather than follow the messaging, I would be offended at that. Person who kind of tried to make that messaging.
Well, actually,
but
there's continuity to that because during the Prop 8 fight in particular, but, you know, all throughout, there's been this sort of backlash against the LGBT community, which a lot of African Americans just plain old think is white. You know, they think gay
mm-hmm.
equals white, number one. But part of the, and this is frankly logical. You know, they go, well, wait a second, you know, black people were hanged. Black people were not even allowed to set foot in through the front door of a hotel, couldn't sit at a restaurant, the lynching just without, I mean, just offhanded, all the Jim Crow laws, et cetera, et cetera. And it was so obvious because it was the color of their skin, whereas white people, white gay people, could pass. So if you're gay and you're white, you still get in to go through the front door, and you still are not, you know, they don't come for you to lynch you. What is not taken into consideration with that, when I've had these kinds of discussions with people, is that, you know, like people of color, you know, back in the day and still today, especially for trans people, there is this constant pall over your head. There's this constant living with fear. I mean, trans people can't
sure.
walk out the door right now without worrying if they take one step they might, you know, be dead. But additionally, back in the day when they couldn't sit in at lunch counters, first of all, we were black too, like Bayard Rustin. Bayard Rustin was Coretta Scott King's friend. Coretta Scott King introduced Bayard Rustin to Martin. Bayard Rustin then mentored Martin Luther King. So this whole, you know, homosexuality thing, and he was open, you know, goes way back. But the deal is that we had to deal with the prospects of lobotomy. We had to deal with the prospects of, you know, being called a sissy and having a baseball bat taken to your head at any goddamn minute, no matter what. You know,
right.
Butch women had to constantly fear being raped so that they would find out what they were missing. So even though, you know, the color of the skin wasn't, you know, prominent, we could pass, you know, sissy boys, effeminate boys, sometimes couldn't butch it up and pass for masculine. Sometimes
right.
masculine women couldn't be feminine enough and got raped. So there was constant terror, and frankly, still is. So,
yeah,
again, my two cents.
Horrors can be different, but still impactful. Brody, you had points?
Yeah, one of the things that I've learned, and this has come from talking and interviewing people at the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's come from talking to people in the Christian right. I am probably one of the few journalists that they'll actually talk to. That's only because I don't, you know, beat them up and call them names, I guess, as much as I probably should. The biggest argument that they constantly and continuously make, and Dan, I think I remember a piece one of your writers actually said about this too, their argument with the LGBTQI community in general is that sexual orientation and gender identity is not an immutable characteristic the same
That's
as race.
Right.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
And they draw the line there. And this campaign, as Dan just mentioned, you know, they threw it to the Jim Crow era of making a comparative. Well, here, you know, we had colored waiting rooms and colored restrooms and colored drinking fountains, but you never saw that with gay people because it's not an immutable characteristic, and they're free, okay, to be straight people. I mean, that argument I heard from the Christian right more than once. You don't have to be gay.
Right.
You can be straight, you know. this is an important distinction. And here's the thing, though. It rings a bell with the black community. Alvin McEwen, who's a blogger from Columbia, South Carolina, and I always screw up the name of his blog. It's Headless Holy Bullies and something or other. Daniel Public has to correct me or Karen. But Alvin is black, and Alvin has been writing about this issue for quite a while. The wedge issue with the black church is that immutable characteristic. That was an argument that Bernice King made during the marriage equality fight. It was, believe it or not, we heard it even during the period of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And now FRC has brought it out again and recycled it. And they're also playing, I think, off of the cynicism that we've seen because of what's going on, okay, with the Trump administration. And they are directly playing off of the white supremacy nonsense that we've seen at Charlottesville and we've seen everywhere else. And they're trying to make mom-pop, apple pie, Chevrolet, and the Walmart customers believe, okay, that the gay community is drawing a line there that shouldn't be drawn, and that religious freedom is what's really at stake here. And then one more thing, I'm going to let you guys go. But the last thing is that the Sessions Justice Department has now asked the Supreme Court of the United States to be able to present 10 minutes in the oral arguments on this very thing that we're talking about. That is significant because that is a departure. It's also the Sessions Justice Department agreeing with these black churches and agreeing with that same thought process that you can't say Jim Crow, which is what they claim the LGBTQI community keeps saying, when it's not an immutable characteristic.
Right. I think what you guys have brought up, you and Karen, especially on that viewpoint of and those perceptions are extremely valid and poignant in the topic. Dan, you brought up something, though, that I thought was very interesting looking forward, where this encouragement of this rift has worked in the past. But I think to your point about eating places and the case that's going to go before the Supreme Court with the wedding cake guy, that this could actually not work as well. Because what I've seen with a lot of people, a lot of the Americans I've talked to who are sympathetic towards cake bakers and small businesses, that are people who have small businesses, and they like the idea that they can refuse service to anyone. And my perception would be that the African community, American community, would be one of the ones that would be most sensitive to that being, subterfuge for we're going to turn down black people. And so that it might get them a little less eager to warm up to making that okay to ostracize yet another group, even if the characteristics are innate or non-innate. I think it's going to, pardon the expression, leave a bad taste in their mouth. So I think that's going to be interesting to watch, to see that reaction.
Well, remember
Dan, did you have any...
back. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No.
I just
mean,
wanted to see if Dan had any.
I hope that's the way it goes. I mean, and I think we also, our side, needs to adequately, draw those connections, not sort of say it's the same thing, water fountain to water fountain, but that, yes, it's, they don't want the right to refuse gay people. They want the right to start refusing whoever they want. And that's code for people of color, immigrants, whoever.
Right.
We need to make that abundantly clear.
Right. No. And Karen, you had another point?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Ron Paul made that point got into a lot of trouble with that with Rachel Maddow back in the day when he was, I don't know whether he was thinking about running for president or just re-election or whatever, but Rachel Maddow asked him about his refusal to agree with the Civil Rights Act. And he said, I do not agree with the Civil Rights Act because I think every single business owner has the individual right to decide who he or she wants to serve in their business. That, and it was all about the individual rights as opposed to, the public good, essentially. So I'm not so sure that Ron Paul argument might not be taken up in the name of religious liberty.
I think there's a libertarian bent on it that will get thrown on the table, because that is definitely there. I kind of want to switch gears a little bit on you guys to an area that is very near and dear to all three of your hearts, and that is the Trump administration and the White House particularly really kind of ostracizing LGBTQ media and not giving access. Is that a true thing, or is that just the way it seems, perception?
Brody, you want to go
first?
I'll take the shot at that. I'm going to let Dan and let Karen have it. Karen, of course, this affects Karen's colleague, Chris Johnson at the Washington
mm-hmm.
Blade. It's more than just a perception. It's a reality. It's the fact mm-hmm. that when Spicer was press secretary, Chris was, in fact, being called on. The minute Sarah Huckabee took over, forget that. And it's the anti-gay animus which comes with her background, and even more so because she's been empowered by a vice president who has gone after, well, for the most part, the trans community this past summer, but indirectly he's gone after the gay community as well. And there's no one there to really call her on it. Chris has sent a couple of emails, which he published in the Washington Blade, talking about, he got back the, I'm not trying intentionally, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, yeah, you're lying. you're lying. I mean, the biggest problem, and I say this as someone who also covered that beat for a while, Chris Johnson is the principal White House correspondent for the Washington Blade, which has been D.C.'s premier LGBTQI newspaper since its inception. I think it and Mark Siegel's Philadelphia Gay News are the two oldest gay newspapers literally in the country. And
Windy City Times.
It's really critically important that presence is in that briefing room and that there's representation there. Because, you've got a senior editor like Dan who's sitting in New York with his crew and his staff. And Dan, as an editor, relies on information coming out of the flow from those briefings, and he's not going to get the LGBTQI basically spin or take or interpretation on it if the press secretary is not calling on Chris. So not only is it
right.
a distraction, and it not only does it affect negatively the Blade, but it also impacts people like Dan, and it impacts people like Karen. And at the end of the day, even though I'm a mainstream journalist, I don't work for the gay press anymore, but it also impacts me as a gay man because I don't get to see what the interpretation is because my representative journalistically is being shut out. Dan?
Right. Actually, I've got a question that I want to throw into the mix this too. And Dan, you can answer it. Is what Brody's describing through the past three administrations, obviously under Obama, I'm sure it was pretty good for the gay press. Was the gay press in there during the Bush administration? So if you could give perspective on that as well. Dan?
I believe Chris was. Well, no, not Chris, but I guess his predecessor.
Carrie Olivet?
I don't know how much access, but Chris wrote a first-person piece in the Blade kind of laying out what was happening, and I believe in that he said that the Blade had had access during the Bush administration. But they even had it, with Trump previously with Spicer. So this is definitely, a change.
So the thing is that my turn?
Let me pop in another little question. I'm going to be the question guy on this one. Is Huckabee Sanders obvious upbringing and bias weeding in here beyond the Trump administration, the regular badness of the Trump administration. Is that part of this, Karen, do you think? And then your comment.
Well, I do. I mean, because what Chris says, and if you watch the press briefings, you can see it yourself. But there was one instance in particular where she called on the woman right in front of Chris. The thing is, Chris has been a White House pool reporter. So he's a member of the White House Press Association. The Washington Blade goes to the White House Press Association dinners, you know, on and on and on. You know, Lou Chabarro was honored by the National Press Club. I mean, this is not a little, you know, spec outlet. I know that at least our congressional representatives are very well aware of the Washington Blade. And we're very excited to hear that the Los Angeles Blade was going to be the sister publication because, you know, it kind of is a hometown thing. But here's the deal, is that when Sarah Huckabee Sanders looks directly at Chris and then chooses the reporter sitting in front of him, that is a direct insult, not just to Chris, but to all of us. Because everybody in that room, because of the nature of the questions that he asks, and because, you know, he knows them, knows, you know, who and what community he represents. I mean, everybody knows who April represents as well. So by, you know, by screwing around with April, you know, she's slapping the African-American community in the face. By shutting out Chris, it is a deliberate smack in the face and an insult. Now, in previous administrations, not only was there press access to varying degrees, but additionally there was some form of liaison, you know, whether it was Brian Bond who I had problems with, actually. He was more of a liaison to the donor community than the press. When Pam Spalding and Carrie Elovedd and I sort of jumped on his case for that. But there was some sort of access to the White House, Valerie Jarrett, whomever. I mean, there was some sort of, you know, communication if you didn't go through the press corps. So, you know, we have to consider that we are representing a people by sitting in that press room. It's not just Chris. It's not just the Washington Blade. It's who we represent as well. Anyway,
yeah, really great point. Yeah, and I think this is interesting perspective that a lot of non-journalists are not necessarily aware of. I've got a related question about what's going on in the Trump administration, kind of throwing it up against this environment. Currently, there is a nominee in front of Congress for the ambassadorship to Germany, who is gay, and is getting a lot of Democratic opposition for comments that he's made in the past that have been misogynistic. My twofold question to the three of you guys. One is this being asked about and discussed in the press room, and how is Sanders handling that? And number two, is there this kind of weird two-step with the Trump administration where he's trying to do pro-gay stuff in his own way some places and then allow the absolute worst homophobes do their thing in other parts of his administration? Open that to any one of you guys.
Well, you know, look, you go ahead, Dan, you go first, and then I've got to chime in here, too.
I was going
to
say the same thing. I don't think, you know, he's making any efforts in our direction, you know, this ambassador being gay. If that is his idea of a gesture to the LGBT community, I mean, it's practically non-existent. I have to guess that his sexuality was just, you know, besides the point. It was, you know, a donation or whatever it is that landed in that spot. But it also showed that Just because you're a member of the LGBT community doesn't mean you can't be, well, I won't say a word that you probably shouldn't say on the radio, but...
well, we can just
you know what I mean. Yeah, doesn't keep you from being a sexist or an idiot or any or a supporter of Donald Trump or any of those other things.
Well,
yeah.
I've got my theory.
I
think he got
radio.
That. I think he was named because he's been a pundit on Fox News. I mean, Rick Grenell, you know, Rick Grenell used to work for the UN, for a Republican, I think it was in the Bush administration, but he used to work at the UN embassy, et cetera, et cetera. So he's got, you know, he's got the background. He's been a really good, solid Republican conservative. And, you know, and frankly, he's very well spoken and he thinks quickly on his feet. But I think what got him the job and what got him the attention is how he defended Trump as a gay person, but how he defended Trump on Fox TV as a pundit. Trump loves his pundits. Trump loves Fox TV. That's it. That's that. And plus he has some credentials, you know, to back him up coming from the UN long time ago,
right.
But he can do
right.
it. Being misogynist, talking, going to a country that's run by a woman, I don't even think that crossed his mind. Trump was just as misogynist by refusing to shake her, you know, Merkel's hand.
Yeah, I was going to say
so
he
Democrats
sort of set the
have the problem
that.
With
yeah.
the misogyny, not the Republicans.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that was the point. Yeah, it was the Democrats that were going up against it. Brody, I think you have a question for Dan.
Actually, I do. It's my opportunity to get have our listeners, you know, find out a little bit more. You run a news outlet, and I'm an unabashed fan, and I have you in my feed. And as you know, I think you guys are great. Why don't you tell us just a little bit about what it is you do and your ideas and editor and coverage? Because you guys cover a wide range of topics. You guys just don't focus in on one thing. We kind of get the Reader's Digest, you know, let's hit everything with you guys. And I think some of the stuff you guys talk about is wonderful. Give me an idea of what it's like to sit at the top of the heap there every day in New York and do your job.
Sure, thanks. I think we do cover a wide diversity of things. Part of that is my sort of, ADD kind of interest in everything. But we start to, you know, we have our kind of breaking news, got to you know, hit the priorities. And then we've been adding a lot more perspectives, opinion pieces. Really, I think it seems like since the election, you know, trying to give voice to people that really feel like, you know, they're not being heard or that they, you know, they don't have a voice. We have a team of about six or seven people full-time, Monday through Friday. Then there's a weekend editor, and then probably with columnists and contributors, another four or five people. And then we kind of connect with Logo on, you know, larger things, sometimes a show, sometimes a tent pole. We honored once a year. We have Logo Trailblazer honors people like Baird Rustin or Harvey Farstein, and Minimex kind of provides a lot of context for that as well. So it's a lot of different things. It's obviously mostly print online, but it's also video and also on television too.
Okay, that's a little multimedia stage in there. One of the things that I appreciate about your operation and what you do is the very fact that you've got that diversity, you've got that variety, and the way that, you know, topics are being covered. I know you and I have talked about sometimes getting caught in the LGBTQ bubble, and you're not really aware of the greater world around you sometimes. And I came from the gay press after almost 7 year stint, so I can appreciate that. But it's nice to be able to look at what you're doing and say, okay, well, we're going to do this, but then why don't we cover this little subject over here that maybe nobody else is paying attention to? And that's one of the things that I think Dan, is, you know, it, as an editor myself, I know that's important. That's what I tell my reporters, and you know, you being an editor, the same thing, Rob.
I think that's kind of the secret.
Yeah, and I want to kind of going on that theme of the broader topic. I kind of wanted to focus you guys on what was happening today with Trump and his war on the opioid crisis. It struck me as a little bit interesting. I mean, there's obviously an issue there, a real issue to go after. But within the LGBT community, I know there's a methamphetamine issue that is really, really big with a lot of young gay men. There are other drug issues as well that don't seem to be under this umbrella. And when I did a little research on the opioid crisis, one of the pieces I saw described it as, quote unquote, mostly a white working class issue, that that's where these drugs were being abused the most. I wanted to get your guys' comment on that. What are your thoughts?
Can I jump in?
Absolutely.
I think we're going to see something very different than the previous, war on drugs, which was, you know, throw people in jail, punish them, you know, because those drugs, crack and stuff like that, were, you know, in the urban environments, and they were targeting African Americans, and we can throw them in jail. But as you say, the opiate addiction, at least as it's being perceived now, is being aimed at the white middle class. So we're not going to be throwing people in jail. You know, we're going to be talking treatment. We're going to be talking decriminalization. We're going to be talking all the things that we tried to talk about, you know, with the other drugs. And I just find it very, you know, interesting and a bit disheartening.
I find it very interesting that all of a sudden a Republican administration is basically talking about needle exchange and do no harm. I mean, they're talking about providing places where people can shoot up using clean needles, you know, so that people don't die. And they shoot up in these sort of safe galleries, if you will, that have time clocks and have buzzers in case somebody feels like they're, you know, about to go out and OD, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you know, I remember when the law enforcement cracked down on needle exchange over, you know, over the AIDS crisis, because needle exchange would just lead to more drug use. And by the way, people are still being thrown into jail over marijuana and crack cocaine and things like that. And Narcan is not effective, does not help at all with crystal meth ODs. And crystal meth is a big epidemic in the gay community, especially now underground, but, you know, in the black gay community. And a lot of people don't realize that there are other health factors, like diabetes, for instance, that can cause death, not just overdose, if you slam crystal meth and you have diabetes. I mean, there's a real quick OD leads to death in that regard. Nobody's talking about that. So,
right.
You know, and
Brody,
then plus we have a history. You know, we have a history of alcohol and drug abuse anyway, because of, you know, of the shame of being gay. You know, that and where we would meet would be in bars, and now it's hookup places, and, you know, do you party and play, and, you know, on and on and on. So, no, we're not being paid attention to.
Yeah, not much. Brody, you had a point?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we need to remember, and Dan just started to bring that up, and I'm going to reiterate that, is that we have an administration, more importantly, you know, we have an attorney general who's trying to throw things back to the 1980s. Sessions warned in a speech he gave, you know, this is covered by BuzzFeed, you know, he warns America to just say no to drugs, and he adds that much of the addiction starts with marijuana, and that's a misnomer. We know that that's not true. But this is the type of archaic thinking that doesn't do anyone any good. When it comes down to opiate and the opiate crisis, particularly in the Midwest and other places, according to the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, they have told me that they have seen a 37% increase. And this includes all sorts of prescription drugs, to the point of where it affects the gay community. According to Mark King, the blogger and columnist who writes My Fabulous Disease, and we had Mark on the show a few weeks ago, one of the largest issues that have to go with it is the fact that we have also the same factors that are affecting the LGBTQI community that are affecting everyone else when it comes down to this opioid crisis. And the problem is now we have an administration that wants to set the clock back to the 1980s and start all over again with a war on drugs that has proved to be A, ineffectual, B, doesn't work, and C, at the end of the day, is highly costly. So I think that we need to, as at least as far as journalists go, and Dan and Karen, I don't know how you feel about this, but from my perspective as an editor and as a journalist, this is what we need to hem in on. And, you know, when Sessions comes forward and says, just say no to drugs, it's just like, you know, no, this is not the way to approach it. We need a proven method, and we need methodology that's not going to take us back to something that is completely unworkable.
Right. I also think that the calling out on the systemic racism of it is an important discussion. Because Dan brought this up before about, you know, who's doing it, and the remedy for one group is to round them up and throw them in prison, and the other group is to, you know, do, which is actually a more effective response to both sides, which is get more treatment, get more of that kind of recovery availability. But it's also gone down to the point where when a drug was called crack, it was handled one way in the community that used it, and when it was called cocaine, and the community that used it, it was treated completely differently, even though they're essentially doing the same thing.
I may just interject here, as somebody who is in recovery, I have 37 years clean and sober, thanks to the employee assistance program that's at CBS News. They threw me in the program in 1980, and I'm forever grateful. I really do need to interject that while we are making this critique, and I do think it's an important critique, let's not forget that people really are dying behind this. This opioid crisis is a real thing, and a lot of it has to do with pain over loss of jobs or hurt back or whatever, and then the pills are too expensive. That's something we can all relate to, is the high cost of drugs. And then in order, because they can't afford the pills anymore, they go to heroin, which is laced with fentanyl, et cetera, et cetera. And now you have, you know, parents of infants nodding out in their cars while the infant is in the back seat. I mean, this is a real issue. And my heart goes out to people, anybody who's struggling with addiction, and by the way, the people who have to deal with people like me who struggle with addiction. We are not fun to be around when we are in our throes of addiction. So, I mean, just to throw that out there, that this really is a real thing at the same time, and we can also continue to have our critique.
Yeah, I being one who is only 2 years behind you with 35 years, I totally get that, and I would emphasize that I'm not minimizing the need for this recovery in one area, but it is I think it's really, really important to reach out to the people who are dying and damaged in the other areas as well. I mean, this is when the discussions of racism are going on, and a lot of people don't get it because they're thinking, hey, you know, I'm not racist. I don't treat anybody in a racist way. They're not looking at the systems, and this is yet another system. And I agree with you. The core of it, you know, for the people it's targeting, you know, if it was across the board, absolutely, and it is a disease and people do die, and go insane and all that. But it needs to, this is where equality does need to come in. And we need to have
it be interesting if this winds up being the one area, this kind of shared commonality around drug addiction, and then we can throw alcoholism in there as well. But drug addiction, I mean, that could be the bridge between the progressive community and the, you know, and the Ohio folks who are Republican and voted for Trump and are now understanding what addiction is and needs help. It could be a bridge that, you know what I mean?
I agree with you. I in fact, I would say that's what I would encourage you guys, you journalists, to really capture that story, because I agree with you 100%. I think it would be a fantastic bridge. And the other point I was going to bring up that ties into that is the irony that Mike Pence was such an ad, you know, completely ballistic going against the needle exchange program in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so now it's really ironic. So I think there's all sorts of ways that this could be, you know, we could, you know, broaden this out and get them to understand this is needed across the board.
Did you see another county in Indiana just discontinued its needle exchange program?
Oh, geez.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah, that's like bizarre. So, guys, I want to switch a little bit to some kids that have been harmed, and the kind of the adult backdrop behind their harm. There's a story, Logan Panetta of Fresno, and a school board president there who is completely anti-gay. She's a lesbian, and her 16th birthday was pelted and gay-bashed. And then a trial for little Gabriel Fernandez, who's an 8-year-old who was killed by his mother's boyfriend because he was exhibiting effeminate characteristics, and the homophobia of that parental figure trying to train him and basically bully the gay out of him. Your comments on those?
I'm going to go ahead and defer this one to Dan because New Next Now has covered both of these, and I think it'd be kind of interesting to get Dan's. I like Dan's spin on this rather than me because I'm more the political jock. Dan, go ahead.
Well, Logan, especially, you know, what happened to her was just terrible, especially on her 16th birthday. But the way she handled it and the way her mother handled it really, you know, gave me hope. You know, 16 is really young, and, you know, she said, I know who I am, you know, I know that I'm gay, and I like myself, I just wish these people wouldn't do this, and then her mother was just so, you know, supportive of her, that at least, you know, we can't, at least not yet, create the, you know, safe environment, but at least she can go home and know, you know, she's safe at home, because for too many people, you know, they face bullying at school and then they come home and they don't even have a safe place at home. So for that, you know, I guess that's something of a silver lining. For the little boy, I mean, that whole story is so monstrous, I can't even begin to fathom it. It's just monstrous. And more is coming out about the things that both his mother and the mother's boyfriend did to him.
I wrote a story about that at the time, if you guys are interested in what happened.
Actually, I did too. I did too. Go ahead, Karen.
Okay, well, I'll read from my story at the time. I'll try to do it quickly. Gabriel's mother, Pearl Fernandez, called 911 on May 22nd, 2013, to report that her son was not breathing. She told sheriff's deputies who arrived at the apartment that Gabriel had fallen and hit his head on a dresser, according to testimony. When paramedics arrived, they found Gabriel naked in the bedroom, not breathing, with a cracked skull, 3 broken ribs, and BB pellets embedded in his lungs and groin. He died 2 days later. quote, "It was just like every inch of this child had been abused," testified James Cermak, a Los Angeles County Fire Department paramedic. "The abuse worsened in the month leading up to Gabriel's death, according to testimony from two of his siblings, both of whom are minors. They said Gabriel was forced to eat cat feces, rotten spinach, and his own vomit. He slept in a locked cabinet and wasn't let out to go to the bathroom. Fernandez and Aguiar called Gabriel gay, punished him when he played with dolls, and forced him to wear girls' clothes to school," the siblings said. Fernandez and Aguiar hit Gabriel with a belt buckle, a metal hanger, a small bat, and a wooden club, Gabriel's brother said. Their mother once jabbed Gabriel in the mouth with a bat and knocked out several teeth, according to testimony. So this is a little, I mean, geez, how can these kids endure? Eight years old and a preventable death.
Yeah, it's true. And my piece that came out at the time juxtaposed exactly what you just described against a seminar that the Catholic Church was running at the time about one man, one woman, and how children needed to be influenced into that thinking. And my request was that Pope Francis give the eulogy for Gabriel, because he needed to see the effect of that kind of positioning and you know, what transpires because of it. So, guys, I want to thank you all for being on board. I want to thank you all for joining us. Dan, welcome. You're welcome back anytime.
Thank you. Great input.
And thank you for all that you do. Brody, you had a couple of special announcements you wanted to shout out. Brody?
Yeah, it's kind of a community calendar, if you will. Dan, the first one you might be interested in. The Matthew Shepard Foundation is kicking off its 20th year on November 16th at the Stonewall Inn at 53 Christopher Street in New York City. There'll be a cabaret and a fundraiser from 7 to 9:30 p.m. There's going to be performances, readings, drag, live music, including Jamie Wilson, who was a guest on our show. And then also another one of our guests, Arcadian Broad, who is an LGBTQ ally in Orlando, Florida. The Orlando Ballet Company and School, in conjunction with the Orlando Philharmonic Orchestra, is staging its season opener of Swan Lake this Saturday, October 28th, at the Dr. Phillips Center for the Performing Arts in Orlando, Florida. Arcadian will be making his debut as Prince Siegfried, for those of you that follow ballet. He's an incredibly talented dancer, and after Pulse, the Orlando Ballet Company was just amazing in giving support to the community. Dan, I also wanted to thank you for coming on. It was just wonderful to have you as a guest.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks to all of you. Listen again next week on Rated LGBT Radio, 7 p.m., this blog talk station, 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 p.m. Eastern. Also listen on Saturday night, 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, to www.ksco.com for Out in Santa Cruz. This week we will be talking about Georgia and their call for quarantine of HIV people. That'll be one of the main topics, along with other topics of the day. So, again, thank you to all my guests and regular panelists. You guys are awesome. Go out there and kick butt. And, oh, by the way, Dan, one added note, you can cuss on this show. So just for next time, save up all your cuss words. So thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.